What is up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Year of Plenty podcast, the show for all things real food and the processes that bring it to the table. As always, I'm your host, Paul DeWieland, and I'm super excited to share this episode with you all today. So today's episode is a conversation with Devin Pettigrew, who actually just finished his doctoral program in archaeology. Devin has been on a quest to research ancient hunting weapons and tactics and broader implications of these aspects on social organization, economy, and human-environmental relations. You know, he's done a bunch of awesome experiments with ancient hunting weapons, and, you know, one of his primary focuses is studying the atlatl and dart, which is one of those ancient hunting weapons that we'd really dive deep to in this episode. And in fact, he's even made these atlatls and darts himself and is quite proficient at throwing them. So just for a quick episode overview, you know, we get into Devin's story, how he got obsessed with all of this. We then talk about the ancient piercing weapons used for hunting. So we're talking about lances, javelins, the bow and arrow, and the atlatl and dart here. Then we get into the timeline, the evolution of these hunting weapons. We also talk about what would be an ancient big game hunter's gear list, or what would that look like. And then toward the end, we get into how archaeologists actually study the evolution of ancient hunters and their weapons. And, you know, these are just a couple of the awesome topics that we got into this episode. It's, I think, almost 2 hours, so a lot of content in here, a lot of just fascinating stuff that I had no idea about, and that I know that a lot of you are going to get really excited about as well. So, as always, this is the Year of Plenty podcast. If you enjoyed the show, absolutely incinerate that subscribe button. Leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Spotify now has reviews, so please, please, please go over to the Spotify app if you use that. Leave that 5-star review. You don't even have to leave like any words. You don't have to write anything. Just literally hit that button if you get value from the show. That is one of the best ways to help the show grow. But you know what's even better than that? Is share it with a friend. Word of mouth, getting it out there. If you know anyone else who might be interested in these topics that I cover here in the podcast, just send an episode that you really enjoyed over to them, and, you know, let them know what it's all about, and maybe they will also get a lot of value from it. So, you know, if you do absolutely love the podcast and you've shared it with a friend, you've left a review and whatnot, what you can also do is support it with a $2 donation on Patreon. It's a monthly donation, but it's only $2. That's less than a cup of coffee. If you're interested in supporting the show this way, the Patreon link will be in the episode description. Finally, you can also follow me on Instagram, which is at Paul D. Wieland. Again, a link to that is in the episode description. It's PoldiWieland. Feel free to reach out to me. You know, leave me a DM, a direct message. I love getting a conversation started with you all. And, you know, I learned a bunch from you guys on Instagram and other social platforms and just discussing some of these topics. And you guys give me great feedback. You know, over there on Instagram, you can let me know if there are any topics you'd like me to cover, if there are any cool guests you think might be fitting for the podcast. So, yeah, just absolutely give me a follow there and feel free to reach out. Okay, that's it for me. Get ready to hear from Devin Pettigrew. Devin, welcome to the show, man. Very excited to talk to you today about ancient hunting technology, ancient hunting weapons, kind of some of the tactics that were used. And I've been following you on Instagram for a couple months now and, you know, read some of the things on your website, some of the articles you sent over, all really great stuff, as we just discussed before, hitting the record button. But, you know, before we get really into the meat and potatoes of all this, all the, you know, the deep dive, I'd love to kind of hear how you got started in all of this. You know, has archaeology been something, or is that something that's always interested you? Or was there like a significant moment in your life where you really had the, you know, aha moment and you knew you would want to get into this field?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first off, thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure. And it's a great opportunity for me. I have been interested in hunting and old hunting, old weapon technologies for a really long time. I can remember when I was, you know, a very young teenager, or maybe I was 11 or 12, I lashed a pocket knife to a stick I was trying to stalk squirrels with it.
Oh man.
This Boy Scout.
Did you succeed?
Yeah, I had like,
oh no way.
No, I had gotten myself a pair of moccasins, kit moccasins from the Boy Scout store and put them together. And I was like, now I need a spear, and went after squirrels. And so, yeah, for a very long time, I've been doing this kind of thing. I'd say my dad, who was a big hunter growing up and took us hunting all the time and was really interested in this stuff himself, he got me into it. And he had a book. I remember he had a book about making atlatls and slings. He had gotten it somewhere on vacation or something that he showed us in Boy Scouts. And at some point, I just thought, I'm going to dig that up and put some of these things together. And so I think I was probably 15 or 16 when I made my first atlatl and was out in the neighbor's field.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Throwing it around.
I feel like that's a very young age to get into that kind of stuff, you know, and start building your own like ancient weapon technology. I love that.
No, I mean, it's the time to get started with this stuff, although, you know, it's never too late to pick something like this up.
Right. And after that, you decided you would actually want to go study archaeology, I assume.
Yeah, it was my first semester of college. I realized I was not in the right college and I wanted to study anthropology and archaeology. And so, which, you know, is quicker than some people. I think I just immediately understood, or very quickly going into college, understood that that's what I actually wanted to do. So, I had developed that interest from a young age and then just kept pursuing it.
Awesome. And where are you now? You're finishing up your doctoral degree, or where would you be at in your studies?
Yeah. Now I'm kind of in limbo because I defended my dissertation, back in August, got that all through. And, so now it's just a matter of, you know, going through the paperwork. I've done the paperwork. They just have to send me the degree. So now I'm trying to get things published and get a job.
Awesome.
That's the next step. Now I have to become an actual adult.
Hey, but you're still going to be doing some awesome stuff that, you know, I'm sure that like passion you've had as a boy is still with you today for all this.
Yeah, well, I mean, you see me sitting here playing with an atlatl I recently made. I mean, I have these things like laying on my desk and they're just a constant distraction. I'm definitely still just really nuts about them.
Yeah, they look great. I do bow hunting, and I know you're a hunter too, right? So I've never thrown an atlatl or anything. I'm in Montana now, and I'd love to find someone out here who could teach me. It would just be cool to meet that kind of, you know, ancient way of hunting and kind of understand it from like a personal perspective, not just read about it in books.
Yeah, a good way to find people locally, especially you know, if you're anywhere in the United States, but in Europe as well, try and look for like old weapon technology events, usually nap-ins, where people are flint napping. If you look up nap-ins and you find one in your local area, that's a really great way to get started, because you're more than likely going to find somebody who, you know, knows a little bit at least about one of these weapons. And there are atlatl events in the United States and in Europe. People have events specifically to mess with these weapons.
So is it a decently big community? Like, is the community pretty
big? It's a pretty small community.
Okay.
It used to be bigger. The World Atlatl Association, I think it's down to below 500 people now. I think it used to be up to above 3,000 or something like that. So never huge, but you still can find events around the country.
So there's really only like 500 people in the world that still kind of are in tune with how this kind of technology works.
In these associations.
Okay.
There's a lot of people that are really into this kind of thing that, you know, they don't see any kind of need to to go to an event or socialize about it. Yeah. So if you can find those people, then yeah, they're out there.
Right. So let's dive into it. You know, first of all, I'm kind of curious when you're like, as an archaeologist out there looking for signs, specifically for like signs of this ancient hunting weaponry and residues and whatnot, like what kind of residues do you guys encounter usually? Is there like something you can pinpoint and say, this is something that, you know, we usually find very often?
Yeah. In North America, you're talking about stone points. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you think about these weapons, you can make the complete weapon system out of all organic materials that are all going to degrade and decompose in most conditions, although you'll find some conditions where you're either lacking oxygen or lacking water. If you're missing either of those two components, you can have a situation where, you know, wood preserves. So, you know, in caves and desert areas or in like bogs, you'll have preservation. But mostly you're going to have stone. That's what sticks around in most conditions. And for the most part, the only thing made of stone on these weapons, if they were making anything of stone at all, was the armature, the tip of the projectile. And so this is the thing that does the work, right, on what it hits. It's cutting a path through a body usually and incapacitating prey that way.
Right.
So because of that, and they have to be well designed to do that, they're what archaeologists call diagnostic, or they're frequently diagnostic, meaning that they take on a particular shape that's unique in time. And so if we can dig down through a site and we find these styles of things, like such as armatures going back through time, and we can date them in a nicely stratified site where there's like, you know, one style on top of another, assuming that the oldest is the one that's at the bottom.
Right. Yeah.
Then we can walk around on the landscape and just pick these things up and say, oh, this here is a late archaic site, but that one over there is middle archaic because we have these diagnostic artifacts. So namely, that's what we're looking at is stone projectile points. And in rare occasions, we get other components of the weapon system preserving.
And then based on the style and where you find them in the strata of the archaeological record, that'll give you an idea of how to group them and maybe, you know, get a timeline going, right? Like of when, which style would have been brought to existence, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And it gives you a really nice way to, you can just do a big survey, you know, a big archaeological survey and look at these sites on the landscape. And you get this, you can do cool things like statistical analysis and say, Dalton, the populations of Dalton hunters in the early archaic were, you know, such and such. They had, you know, such and such a density on this landscape. That's the kind of thing you can do. But unfortunately, diagnostic artifacts are the kinds of things that attract people. They like to pick them up and, you know, put them on their shelves.
Right.
So as time goes on pretty quickly in this country, most of the sites with diagnostic tools, at least where they're accessible on the surface, are, you know, now they're just the debitage and thing. So it's harder and harder to use that method to date them.
Just because, yeah, those sites are being reduced by outside influences, basically.
Yeah. I mean, people are just coming along and picking up the diagnostic artifacts.
Right. I've always wanted to find an arrowhead or like, you know, a spearhead, but I know it's not the thing to do to like take it home, and it's best to leave it there and inform someone, right? That's kind of.
Yeah, I mean, it's best just to. Yeah, just enjoy it in place, and you can snap a photo with your phone, and you know, that's my preferred method, because I don't know about you, but last time I moved house, I realized I had more more junk than I actually need anyway. So
oh, yeah.
No reason to pick up more stuff. Just,
right, and yeah. I guess the one thing is with that, like, if you do bring in the archaeologists, who knows what they might find, right? Could be something really cool, and it I mean, that in itself is maybe even cooler than owning a broadhead at home.
Yeah, yeah. As time goes on, archaeological methods develop. So we love the idea of conserving these things, not only for the, you know, conserving ancient landscapes that are important cultural heritage to everybody, but in the future, there's no telling what we can, what we'll be able to do.
Right. So why study like the weaponry of early hunters specifically?
So early hunting and foraging societies, hunting was a huge component of their lives. And as you know, as a hunter, the ways that you hunt, the tactics and the technologies really affect your ability to be successful.
Right.
And this wasn't all that was obviously all that was important to ancient lives. I think we frequently put too much emphasis on this sort of thing. However, the, you know, they're among the tools that were extremely important to ancient people regardless. So that's why, you know, that's not the reason that I'm obsessed with these things and love playing with them and love trying to hunt with them. But it's, that's the reason why it's actually useful to study them.
Right.
Yeah. We get a pretty good sense of a better sense of what it was like to be an ancient person and why we are the way we are today.
So why are you specifically obsessed with it?
That's a good question.
Not to put you on the spot here, but because you just mentioned it, so
I think, yeah, it's a lot of fun. I mean, when I made a sling and an atlatl for the first time when I was a teenager, I realized like this is challenging, but when you make the thing work, it's so rewarding, you know, and it's so much fun just to be outside. Trying to find the materials to make these things, spending the time. I was an artist from a young age too. And I like to make things. And I like to make like, you know, artistic things. That's not necessary to it, but I like building things. And then to take those out and see that I can like hone my abilities to throw things and, you know, to sneak around and use these things accurately and effectively. It's just a real blast. So that's, I think, what got me thinking about them all the time from a young age and just, you know, being really fascinated by these old tools.
Awesome. So, you know, like I said, I did read part of your dissertation, a good amount of it, and I thought it was all super fascinating. It is like a full book. You know, I was really impressed at how thick it was. I even showed it to my roommate who is doing a PhD right now, and he's like, holy crap, I feel like there's a lot in there. In the dissertation, you basically said that, and this is a quote, you said that advances in weaponry have been attributed to biological developments such as higher cognitive processes in modern humans, social investment in rearing children, and prolonged time for adolescent to maturity. That was super, that really stopped me and made me think. Can you kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. This is coming from a couple of really interesting articles I read. Basically, the idea is weapons, complex weapons, they require more cognitive processes, not to produce them, but because they're kind of complicated and modular and you have multiple components, to put those things together and to use them effectively. So that must have taken, you know, we suspect that must have taken some kind of cognitive leap. And this kind of goes right alongside these biological changes that we're seeing in humans, where unlike any other species of primate, we have this prolonged period where children are growing up, and through adolescence, they still need to be supported and they're gradually learning. They have this long time period, actually, relative to other primates and relative to other early hominins to learn things. So we have this long time where we can learn from our elders. And unlike other primates also, we put a lot of investment into rearing children. And if you look at a lot of hunter-gatherer societies, the way that usually, the form that that often takes is provisioning for women as they're, you know, raising children and when they're pregnant, and acquiring meat. And I'll say this because it's actually very important. Women are excellent hunters, and there are cases where in hunter-gatherer societies, women are hunting big game and they're doing it very effectively. Most often than not, it's the men because it takes a long time to learn to hunt. And right when you're getting into the age where you need to start going hunting, you also are getting the age where you're going to be getting pregnant. So it's kind of, there's kind of a just a biological reason why it tends to be men, but it's not, it's by no means like a natural universal law. And frequently you also have situations where, you know, men are tracking game, but the women are just as good, if not better than their husbands at tracking. And the anthropologists are learning a lot from the women on that topic. But in any case, the idea is here that meat was extremely important. And for a lot of hunter-gatherer societies, it makes up a huge amount of the nutritional intake, such as for the Aceh in Peru, they, you know, or in South America, most of their nutrition comes from meat and from hunting. So as a species, these things all kind of like came together. It's not like one thing was, we're, you know, focusing on that in our evolution. It's just like this gradual like shift, this trend
toward it, yeah,
towards how our species, you know, ended up, which is with these more complex tools, prolonged periods of growth and development as a kid, and more provisioning through these difficult and challenging, you know, pursuits of big game animals that required a lot of knowledge to do effectively as a hominid. We're not fast. We don't have sharp teeth. We have to be smart. That's how we hunt effectively.
Right. And then I think there's also like another couple of hypotheses that kind of go along with that, like the cooking hypotheses, right? That once we figured out how to like cook this meat, that made a lot of it more bioavailable and also increased our capacity, our brain size and capacity for cognitive behavior changes and all that. So it's cool stuff. I love hearing about that.
Homo habilis is, you know, when that species developed, you had this simultaneous switch where you had a larger cranial capacity and also a shrinking of the dentition. So their like mouths and the muscles they needed to chew got smaller, coincident with like larger brains. So it seems to be that they're, you know, right along going side by side is larger cognitive capacity, hunting and cooking of meat. Yeah, and more tool production as well.
And would you say that is pretty like conventional wisdom in archaeology right now? Like, is that across the board kind of accepted?
Yeah, I mean, so we can put too much emphasis on hunting. That's one thing that we should be wary of, because in a lot of hunter-gatherer societies, you know, I think we put too much emphasis because of the way our society views hunting and the importance of hunting. And that's also kind of why it's, I find it problematic to say, you know, men mostly hunted and women didn't. Why do we care? Part of it's because of the emphasis that we place on hunting and like its connection with heraldry, like way back in Western society. You know, there were a lot of important things that people did in ancient times that, you know, help them survive, including in some cases for some societies, this was context specific, foraging for plant material could be, you know, much more important or much more advantageous than spending a lot of time hunting. So we can put too much emphasis on that, but for quite a long time, I think most anthropologists have recognized the importance of hunting and, you know, a higher cognition and that sort of thing.
And meat and more nutrition and all that, right? So if we're looking at ancient hunting weapons, there's really two, like two forms of the of it, right? Two major forms. The one that would be like the plunt trauma weapons and then the piercing weapons. Can you kind of go over those a little bit and maybe tell us when which would be more advantageous?
Yeah. So we have, you know, just for some examples, blunt trauma weapons, just regular thrown rocks, slings that you can, you know, launch a rock with.
Yep.
Thrown sticks, and then if you shape those sticks properly, you can make boomerangs that are like really powerful. So that's the kind of blunt trauma. Also thrown clubs, and then piercing weapons or piercing and cutting weapons like javelins, lances, or thrusting spears. So two different kinds of spears: the atlatl, the bow. What's interesting is that the blunt trauma weapons are really challenging to see archaeologically. And in some cases, the piercing weapons too. If you just make a javelin all out of wood, you know, there's rare instances where that tool is going to survive and that we can find it. So it's, you know, when these weapons come along, when they're really important, and when people are first starting to use them, is it's going to be an open question for a really long time. But I would imagine that going way back, you know, well before our species, that blunt force trauma weapons, just regular thrown rocks or thrown clubs, were what people were primarily using. But they're also using relatively simple like thrusting spears and maybe even throwing spears.
Yeah, the blunt trauma weapons are always so fascinating. And it's just interesting to think about that at the beginning, I'd assume we probably were just, like throwing rocks or heavy things. And I've actually seen a video of, I think it was somewhere in Africa, one of the hunter-gatherer tribes, they were using rocks to basically scare off I think it was a cheetah from a kill. So they basically stole the cheetah's kill. And that was just, that kind of blew my mind. Like, holy crap, these guys have balls.
Right. Yeah, it's a form of scavenging where you go out and you just kind of, in some cases, you just stand up as a group and just, you know, or you're very confident. You just walk towards these lions, run them off, cut off a piece of the kill, and then get out of there and the lions come back. Yeah, you can scavenge meat that way. And modern hunter-gatherers have done so.
Yeah, that's fascinating stuff. So if we're looking more into the ancient piercing weapons, then going away maybe a little bit from the blunt trauma ones, these usually have like linear shafts, right? Like the stick on it, or the lance, like the shaft in the lance, or the actual arrow shaft. And there's four kinds. So I'm curious, you know, can you maybe go over each of these? Maybe give us like a little walkthrough on when they would have, you know, hit the timeline, and explain like with which tactics they would have worked best.
Yeah. So I mentioned these. We got spears, which involve lances or thrusting spears and javelins. And then the atlatl, you can also use the term spear thrower. Atlat is the correct Aztec and Nahuatl pronunciation. Atlat.
That's good to know.
Dart.
I never really know 100% how to pronounce it. So the American pronunciation would be just atlatl, right? Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And then atlat is the original Nahuatl pronunciation.
That's cool.
Where you kind of, the last TL, you instead of, you can say like a T, but if you do the same thing, but use the sides of your tongue, that's how you pronounce that last TL. Atlat. But it's hard to work that into a sentence. So I think it might be too late for me. I'm stuck with the anglicized.
I'm from Germany. And so we say we have kind of similar kind of pronunciation. So it would work much nicer in German, but yeah, in English, it would sound off for sure.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's I've, you know, I know how to say it, but it takes a lot of effort to
to do it. Yeah.
For me to say it continually. So yeah, Atlas or spear thrower or spear schleuder, you would say in Germany. Mm-hmm. And then the bow and arrow. And so for a long time, the timeline we have generally attributed these to is that early people, including Neanderthals, were using lances, simple lances. And we've, you know, speculated that Neanderthals were kind of like wolves. They were like running animals down and stabbing them with lances. And then with humans, with our species, modern humans, you start getting more specialized projectile weapons with javelins. And then later, around 20,000 years ago, we see the first evidence of the atlatl or spear schleuder. And then around 10,000 years ago, the bow and arrow. So, you know, we have this linear progression of technology. But as we look more carefully at the archaeological record, now we're finding the best evidence of the bow and arrow dating back to about 70,000 years
ago. Wow.
In southern Africa. Yeah.
That's 7x.
Yeah, so yeah. 70,000 years ago. Yeah. And then javelins we have from your own country near Shiningen. Mm-hmm. We have wooden javelins that were preserved in a bog and that later became a coal mine. And those were found not too long ago. They date back about 300 to 400,000 years ago.
Whoa.
So those are actually pre-Neanderthal. Yeah. We've got for javelins as well, stone javelin tips. What we our best guess is that they're stone javelin tips based on the size and the manufacture. With impact damage to the tips, they're frequently, you know, impacting hard things like bones or if they're missing their target, hitting rocks in the ground and that sort of thing. So those look like javelin tips and they go back 500,000 years.
That's so crazy. Cause don't we think that like modern humans came 500,000 years ago? Isn't that kind of one of the,
yeah,
the timelines?
Right. Depending on how you want to, you know, divide things up. This is something that biologists are always arguing about is what makes a species in any, you know, different from another in any particular case. It's context dependent. But I think most people would say, yeah, our species goes back about 200,000 years. So before us, archaic humans were using javelins and lances. Our earliest evidence of the atlatl is still about 20,000 years ago, more like 19,000 years ago in Europe. Trick there, though, is that atlatl darts, a lot of people think of like the, you know, throwing at a board in a pub game. The archaic English word dart simply means a light and often fletched spear, so it actually works pretty well. But darts, they can be just as heavy, if not heavier, than javelins. You know, you can have light javelins that are in like the large dart category, and so there's this like big crossover in size range. So just looking at the projectile points, you can't really say for sure,
right,
what's what. So our best evidence for atlatls is about, you know, 19,000 years ago in Europe, where we actually have found from caves components of the thrower itself.
That's awesome.
I don't think, yeah. So to explain that really quickly, an atlatl is it's the throwing mechanism. It's usually something like 2 feet long. It has a little hook on the end, and it has a handle on the other end. So the handle, you know, you grip it. And it's a lever assist. So it basically extends your throwing radius, and that hook, it fits into the end of a light of the dart. And so you're launching this thing from the tail of the dart. You're launching this thing with this stick. And it gives you, you know, more control, a little bit more power. Although, you know, javelins, frequently they're heavier. You have strong people throwing them. They can be you know, carry a lot more energy than a dart.
So is a javelin really just like, does it resemble a spear quite like, is that kind of what it looks like mostly?
Yeah. I mean, you know, yeah, just they're carefully balanced. The thing about javelins is that they're not, you know, it's not that just you pick up a stick and that's your javelin. They're usually carefully shaped and carefully balanced to have weight forward in the right position and, you know, to have the proper characteristics of flight so that they'll fly straight through the atmosphere. Otherwise, they tend to, you know, like the tail will go off in one direction or another and they won't hit their target
right
in line with the trajectory of the shaft. So they're not simple necessarily.
So is that just like this? So that would be the step from thrusting spear or like, you know, a spear that you would poke with to like actually throwing, right? Would kind of be the javelin there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And you're at some point in, you know, our development, our technological development, you are looking at a transition there probably. I mean, chimpanzees actually will use lances, sharpened wooden sticks. And usually it's the females that make them and they go hunting and hunt like bush babies, small primates. And
wow. Really? So, and I've heard that.
At some point, people. Yeah.
I've heard that the apes are now like in the Stone Age, basically, like a lot of the monkey species or ape species.
Yeah. If you look carefully at them and, you know, the more we study those animals, the more we realize that they're pretty sophisticated. They have sophisticated tools. I mean, chimpanzees, they use these little organic tools that they just make quickly. And you really have to be observing them carefully to catch it. And they'll use some, you know, small tool and then I'll throw it away. And if you're really, you know, watching, you can like walk up behind them and pick that thing up and say, oh my gosh. They've like, you know, taken this twig and like tied it or something like that. So the more we observe them, the more we realize, yeah, they use tools like this. But for weapons, at some point there was a transition from lances to javelins. The mm-hmm. trick is though that people kept using lances
as well
and still use them today. Right. So these weapons, they have momentum. They just continue.
It's not like and, that they stop.
Modern. Know. Right. Yes. And this is tricky also for, you know, how we assume that a new weapon was made, it was better, and everybody just gravitated to it. So now we're seeing why this is problematic. Bows come way earlier than we expected. You know, used to think there was a modern behavioral revolution. There was this upper Paleolithic revolution 40,000 years ago. Suddenly, you just have this complexity. People start making art. They start making sophisticated material culture. As we look more carefully at the archaeological record, we see all the implications or all the indications of that way back, even among archaic populations like Neanderthals. They were making art. They were using the environment in more sophisticated ways or more complete ways than we have imagined. And there's just this kind of gradual build where later in time, things are getting more complex and more sophisticated. But that all started, you know, in various locations at various times early on.
Right.
And you can have things like the bow and arrow developed. It shows up at a site. And then later layers at the same site, you see older javelin tips again. That happens in Africa. That happens in places in Europe and Scandinavia. So, you know, it's not just that one thing comes along, everybody gets it. And, yeah.
Right. And I'd assume they maybe I don't know if you know if they had like this sense of tradition, kind of how we have today. And culture and like wanting to preserve maybe an aspect of that. So, you know, I mean, we still today use knives, right? All these traditional hunting knives and all that. So, and there's people out here, I'd assume you and me for sure, you know, that want to see some of these, of this knowledge and these traditions be carried on. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I'm trying to picking your brain here today, because I think it's like important for people to understand how we've used things in the past and how we evolved.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's tradition is extremely important. It's, and archaeology is extremely important. And the reason it's important is because we use it whether we like it or not. You know, we all have a past. We all have like an individual past, but we also have like a social, cultural past
right.
that makes who we are. And we draw from that, whether we realize it or not. And it's extremely powerful because it, you know, informs the way that we think about the world and think about other cultures, other people, and how we interact with the world. So, you know, recognizing this history, this early tradition is extremely important.
Agreed,
and then there's also the economic aspect of it, where for early people, and there were cases in which making a more complex tool that is harder to make, is harder to maintain, wasn't necessarily better. It didn't necessarily help them. So you have situations where historically people were preferring to use these earlier simple weapons and continue using them, even though they had access to later more, you know, quote unquote, sophisticated or quote unquote complex weaponry. They continue to use older technology.
And are the is the atlatl considered to be the first kind of composite, like complex weapon?
I think if we were just looking at the archaeological evidence, the first complex weapon we would say is the bow.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the best our best evidence now comes before the atlatl,
right?
And then there's, you know, overlap between these weapons, significant overlap, and definitely in the New World, but or in the Americas, but in Europe as well, we're seeing evidence of overlap between these weapons.
And
the problem is we haven't looked thoroughly enough in places like Africa.
Mm.
So we, you know, this is just our best guess at the moment.
Right. Yeah. It's exciting though that there's, you know, it seems like I've been hearing a lot of new discoveries lately in like archaeology and anthropology, especially when it comes to like hunting and early human behavior and the food aspect too. I mean, I follow kind of like an ancestral diet. I try to, as best as I can. And maybe it's just, you know, maybe I'm just learning a lot more or seeing a lot more of it because I'm seeking it out. But it just seems to me that there's been a lot of new discoveries lately. Am I wrong in that?
No, I mean, it wasn't until just recently, let's see, early 2000s that really early evidence of the bow showed up. Just recently, there was an article about the bow and arrow going back 48,000 years in Southeast Asia. So, yeah, but these are places that we haven't done a lot of archaeology. You know, unsurprisingly, most of the archaeology has been done in like Europe and developed nations. We haven't done very much archaeology, for instance, in Central or Northern Africa.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. So there's probably a lot of new things that are going to come out here in the future.
Yeah.
Exciting. So what I'm curious about the bow quick. What did that early bow look like? Kind of like a trad bow today, like a traditional hunting bow. Did the arrows have fletchings and all that? Or was there also kind of an evolution in style with the bow?
Yeah, what we see in Southern Africa are the tips, the stone tips that look very much like later arrow tips. They're, you know, they're very small. They're actually what we call transverse arrow points, where the cutting edge of the blade is actually perpendicular to the shaft.
Oh, really?
Which, yeah, it sounds really weird to you, I know. But these have been were used extensively in the old world. There's one or two of them embedded in the vertebra of red deer in Europe. And the best examples of them that I've seen prehistoric come out of the tombs of pharaohs in Europe. They have, you know, the complete arrow with fletching and everything was preserved with that point. And they were used right up to the ethnographic present in Southern Africa. So we don't know what the rest of the weapon system looked like, but if you look at those assemblages, they're using the same kinds of toolkits that modern San hunters in Southern Africa are using. And what they use is a small bow. It's not a heavy draw bow, and they use a poison arrow. That's what they use to hunt with. So, you know, they're sneaking up on animals, hitting them with this arrow and then tracking them. We don't know, you know, if that's what they were doing early on. That's one thing that you should look for as evidence of poison in the archaeological record, because we're just now starting to develop the technology and figuring out how to find poison in the archaeological record.
That's awesome. That's going to be exciting too, I bet. Just because a lot of traditional cultures have used that in the past, right? That when like we still see it today in a lot of like hunter gatherer cultures and whatnot.
Yes, hunting poison was extremely common. Yeah, you know, people don't realize that in North America, indigenous hunters were using poison projectiles a lot of times, and these are projectiles that, if you make a projectile that's poisoned with aconite, for instance, monkshood, which is a flower that, if you look for it, you can find it in marshy meadows and stuff up in the Rockies. That's an extremely potent poison. And, you know, you hit an animal with a poison arrow, it's not going to be on its feet very long. Right. But that poison gets distributed through the body. So you're cooking that meat, you're consuming just a small portion of that at a time. It doesn't have any impact on the hunter.
Yeah, because that's the one thing I was going to ask. Like, I would be, you know, sketched out to be, or that I would consume some of that poison. And also handling it would be weird, I think, you know. What if you get, I always cut myself when I'm butchering and stuff, so.
Yeah, the part you want to be really careful with is making it and applying it. And then, you know, if you've applied it to a weapon, you got to be extremely careful with it. I can't recommend anybody try this unless
right.
It's not on me if you cut yourself. But once you're consuming the animal itself, you just need to avoid. Apparently, you just need to avoid the meat right around the wound.
Okay, I mean, and we still do that today. You know, if you're shooting lead and whatnot, I usually try to cut around that, and it's, you know, the bloodshot and what anyway. They probably wouldn't have had so much bloodshot back then with an arrow, but probably still a decent amount. But yeah,
with a little poison tip, a small tipped arrow. You know, the San use these little barbed points, and you're probably not going to get a whole lot of hemorrhaging around that wound.
Right. So one thing that also really surprised me as I was reading your dissertation, and I had kind of known this in the past, but forgotten about it. And that's that the bow and arrow really, that system really didn't reach the Americas until like a really recent time, right?
Yeah, what we had thought was about 2000 years ago is when people really like take up the bow.
Which is super
getting
recent.
Into the Arctic. Say again?
That's really recent, right? Compared to like the 70,000 years of bow usage that we know of now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there was a connection in the Arctic, you know, across from Alaska to Russia going way back. So you do have really early evidence of the bow there. I can't remember precisely, I think, you know, 7,000 or 5,000 years ago, you start seeing it, but it's like coming and going. So they'll have it for a while, they'll use it, and then the outlet, they'll use that. And then starting probably around 4,000, 3,500 years ago, it's starting to spread down into, you know, towards the US, farther south into North America. And then it's like very gradual that it replaces the outlet. Although at some sites, this is just based on looking at the morphologies and the size, the metrics of stone points, you have these overlaps where you have, for like 1,000 years, you'll have older larger dark point styles persisting. Mm-hmm. And then you'll have a new style, brand new style, like really small points that are very unlikely to be dark points alongside those. And you have these two populations of points, you know, at the same sites. So we think they're continuing to use actually both weapon technologies.
That's awesome. And then like, from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I think you touched on it a little bit earlier, but isn't our body basically designed to like throw, you know, some of these spears and really be throwing things, like throwing weapons and whatnot?
Yeah, I mean, the way our shoulder, you know, we have this, the shoulder that like rotates around nicely. It's not, we've lost some of our good elements for climbing on things. But our bodies, you know, we're really good at throwing things. And that's, there was probably an evolutionary aspect to that.
Yeah, too. I mean, it would make sense, right? That I feel like the other animals, you know, thinking of some birds, they evolved to crack certain nuts with their beak. Like they have different types of beaks. So it would make sense to me that humans as well kind of, you know, especially since we now know that we've been using the lance, I think you said, for like 500,000 years. So I feel like that would definitely,
or the javelin.
I feel like that would, and so the lance even earlier. So I feel like that's definitely enough time for us to kind of, you know, adapt to that, especially if it's used to get food, something that's so necessary for the survival of the species, right?
Right. Yeah. You have this co-evolution of all these different traits, the ability to throw things really well and accurately, smaller mouths for chewing, you know, food that's been processed outside the body before we consume it, larger brains, more time as a kid to grow up and learn things. Yeah. Those are all kind of going hand in hand.
Cool. So I'd love to dive a little deeper into the atlatl, just because I know that's kind of your favorite weapon, I'd assume, because you've done a lot of studies on it, and seems like that's the one you've put most of your focus on. You mentioned it. You kind of explained what it looks like, how it's used. What is like an effective range on an atlatl?
We've got, you know, ethnographic accounts for hunting out to 50 yards, or you can launch them, you know, a weapon, an atlatl and dart that's designed for hunting or for use in warfare, where you have like a dart that's heavy enough to carry enough kinetic energy and momentum and is accurate within a short range. You can generally throw those out to about 70 or 75 yards.
Wow. That's quite, that's yeah, really far. Accurate.
Yeah.
That's way farther than
I thought. People are usually pretty fast.
He's like, I don't even shoot a bow out past like 40 personally. So,
right. You can't imagine. For accuracy, we're looking at a closer range.
Yeah.
And I would say for me to be accurate, like consistent and accurate, if I was going to go hunting, I'd want to be within about 15 yards.
Okay.
So pretty close. Yeah. And that's looking at, you know, Australian hunters, native Australians, when they hunt kangaroos, you know, sleeping animals, they're trying to get close. They're sneaking up, trying to get within 15 or even 10 yards to use the weapon. But they will take shots on running animals further out. And Eskimos will hunt from kayaks, seals. You know, they're throwing this thing. It's a harpoon. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to harpoon the animal. It's sometimes it has a float attached to it, or the shaft itself is operating as the drag mechanism, because it turns sideways when the animal tries to swim off and just drags behind. So they're throwing those farther distances and, you know, dropping those down on seals. And
so how much time does it take to get good at this? Is this like something that I'd assume it's like archery where you really have to hone that skill.
Oh yeah. It's to be accurate. I mean, you can learn to be powerful pretty quickly, and you can learn to throw one of these with straight to trajectory. That's something that I think people need to emphasize when they're practicing, is launching that dart so it's going straight.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you want a straight impact. But to learn accuracy, it's just a constant, you know, it's just like traditional archery, except level up, you know,
yeah.
continuing to hone that skill. You can learn the weapon though. I mean, in about a month, if you're, you know, depending on how you start off, if you start off with somebody showing you how to do it and giving you effective equipment. You know, I started off like building my own equipment and learning, you know, this huge process of learning what's a good atlatl. Big part of it is making it so you have a comfortable, effective handle where you're gripping the weapon. Balance is really important. You need the right balance between the atlatl and the dart. But that depends where that balance point falls, depends on how you're gripping it, your particular throwing method. So there's, you know, when we learn it in our society today, there's so many styles we're looking at and everything. People develop their own individual preferences and methods. But if you have somebody, you know, showing you how to do it, you get good equipment starting off, you can learn to use it effectively, I think, in a shorter amount of time than you might anticipate.
Well, that's encouraging, at least for someone like me who wants to try it and maybe get into it. So I've seen like an atlatl fly, and it seems like the flight pattern is kind of interesting, where it like really, you know, the tip of it is really oscillating, almost like moving up and down.
Yes,
is that always the case, or is that when you're saying trying to throw it straight, you want that not to happen?
Oh no, the dart itself is flexible.
Okay,
it has to be flexible. It has to flex the right amount, you know. If you're familiar with traditional bow, you're familiar with the spine of an arrow.
Yep.
A dart also has to have the right spine. But when you're throwing this thing, you're making this arcing motion. That's just how we throw something, right? Our hand kind of falls, or it comes up and then it falls over. So when you're launching an atlatl dart, it's the same kind of motion. You're throwing something, but you're launching this dart with the atlatl, and you're not going to like stop in mid-throw. Like, you wouldn't throw a football by stopping right there. You make a full follow through. You do the same thing with the atlatl. So the dart has to flex to compensate for your throwing motion and maintain a straight trajectory. And then it's going to leave the hook of the atlatl and go down range, oscillating and rotating. If you look at the shafts in slow motion, they do all sorts of crazy stuff. I mean, this thing's like spinning around and flexing.
It makes for some cool slow-mo videos.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's really fun to watch in slow motion. Especially from the back. If you look at them from the back, it looks like they're just like wild going down range. If you look at them from the side, an atlatl dart that's nicely balanced, it's flexing mostly towards the rear of the shaft. And at the tip, you've got, right off the bat, leaving the atlatl, you've got something like 5 centimeters. What's that? Like 3 inches.
Yeah.
About of oscillation or movement at the tip. And then it kind of attenuates down range. It levels out. But you do have, you know, these shafts are by nature, they're flexible and so intrinsically a little bit less accurate than a bow and an arrow.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And, you know, I know that a lot of cultures like depended on it. And one of them was the Aztecs in the Americas, right? And I heard, or I was reading in your dissertation, I think it was, that they actually used it to hunt waterfowl. Is that correct?
Yeah. Up until the 1960s or 1970s.
Oh, wow. Really? That recent?
Mitchell. Yeah. So yeah, they were using the atlatl dart to hunt ducks in Lake Pátzcuaro, Michoacán in Mexico. Now I think they use shotguns, but so they maintained this tradition for a really long time.
And
it's not like how we, when we think of hunting waterfowl, we're like in a blind, you know, we pop up and they're flying by. They were going in with canoes in this big crescent-shaped formation to these waterfowl that are like congregating on the lake in massive flocks. And then you bust that flock, they all fly up, and you have these darts with these big prongs. Like if you take your hand and you kind of like make a claw, it's like a big prong like that at the end of the dart. You're like just throwing that in.
A judo point that they use for grouse and whatnot, turkey and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a really big judo point with little barbs on the end of each.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes me feel like I'm cheating with the shotgun, but I guess I'd probably be a little more effective. What do you think? Is someone with a shotgun probably going to be more effective than someone who's really good with the atlatl, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think with a shotgun, if you have a shotgun, you load like 3-4 rounds in there. And, you know, you have a pump or even semi-automatic shotgun, you could probably do a lot of damage to those ducks. Yeah.
So, you know, with the evolution of these piercing weapons, do we think that as we became more complex, that we also became more efficient? I know you said that they were still, you know, there was overlap and they still continue to use some of these simpler weapons, but definitely I'd assume that there's some efficiency that comes with the complex composite weapons.
Yeah, that's generally what we assume. And I think in a lot of cases, yes. I mean, when I shoot a bow versus throwing a dart, I can see it. You know, the weapon is, it shoots a little farther accurately. It's a lot faster. But it's just a lot more to take care of. And I like atlatls a lot, to be honest. But in terms of efficiency, you can say, well, are we as modern hunters more efficient? That's one way to ask that question. And look at ethnographic hunters. And if you look at ethnographic Saan hunters, the hunting data on them that's been compiled, they're way more efficient than we are going out in Colorado hunting animals with rifles.
Really?
A lot of people say, well, yeah, in Colorado, we have like, you know, we have people coming in from out east and they don't know what they're doing. That's a big part of it. But even if we were like, you know, if we had like a 20% success rate per day, we'd still be below the average for Saan success rates on big ungulates using spears.
Oh, wow.
So they were, you know, yeah, you can be really efficient with these old weapons. For one, if you know what you're doing. And for two, what I'm finding looking at these data between modern American hunters and Saan hunters is that the Saan are way less dense on the landscape.
Right.
And for anybody who's hunted any length of time, that'll make sense. They have a very low density on the landscape, and that really impacts the way that animals respond to predation, to being hunted. Because if animals are experiencing a high density of predators on the landscape, they increase their anti-predator behavior. You know, they do various things not to be preyed upon.
Right.
And, you know, anybody who's hunted any length of time will know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. They usually become nocturnal, those darn deer, darn bucks.
Absolutely.
So,
yep, that's one of them.
As a species, would you say, I don't know if you can answer this question, but would you say we've been hunting mostly big game? And if that's the case, was there like an obvious switch to small game? And might that have been like influenced by the type of weapons we maybe invented?
Oh yeah, that definitely influenced weapon types. You know, most blunt trauma weapons are useful on small game, although you can make clubs that you can, you know, hit an animal with once you've got it down or in a trap or something. And boomerangs, those weapons are way more damaging than people think they are. I mean, people in Australia and Mesoamerica and in the New World use boomerangs in warfare. So they like, yeah, they break your bones and just crush your skull.
It's such a weird and interesting weapon at the same time. Like I can never imagine hunting with one of those, but
it's
just fascinating.
I would imagine. Yeah, it's such a cool weapon. I mean, and they're really fun. They're hard to make though, but I would imagine for the most of our history as hunters, we've been hunting small game. And then focusing on big game wasn't something that really happened until you started getting into populations of archaic humans like Neanderthals or Homo heidelbergensis who came before Neanderthals.
So when would that be roughly?
Then you start getting...
like on a timeline.
Let's see. Yeah, going back, I can't remember when the first data is on heidelbergensis, but going back, you know, 500,000 years or a million years, you're starting to get into populations of people that are starting to focus on big game. We're still, small game is still a big component of our diet. And if you look at ethnographic cultures, you know, I mentioned that mostly it's the men hunting big game. Frequently you'll have women that are foraging, but also hunting small game right around camp. And you have, groups like the Aceh in South America, when they hunt, it's opportunistic. In the San, when they hunt, it's opportunistic. Sometimes they're going after big game. They're actually tracking some big ungulate, and they're like, oh no, let's dig this animal out of its burrow instead. It's right there. So, right. So yeah, that continues to be like a huge part of our diet.
Because I've talked to an anthropologist who was talking about some evidence that, or basically the narrative that, you know, it would have been a lot easier for us to hunt big game since they often stand their ground. And I'm talking more like, you know, back then, I think the average, the way what he presented was like that the average mammal weight, like 1 million to 2 million years ago, was like 400 kilograms. So they would have had access to a lot more big game. It would have been a little easier to hunt in groups because they often stand their ground. And also, like, if you look at, like, you know, reindeer and whatnot, the herd animals, they're so into their thing when they're migrating. They're so focused on that one thing that they tend to be a little almost stupid, where you could, you know, literally, like he was talking about caribou hunters who would literally be waiting, like laying in ground blinds and waiting for the migrating caribou to just walk past them. And then they'd get up quick and spear them like that. So do you think there's anything to that? Have you heard of any narrative in the anthropology, archaeological community like that?
I mean, the early histories of, there's a really great book if you're interested in caribou.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see. It's called Hunting Caribou, Subsistence Hunting Along the Northern Edge of the Boreal Forest.
Heck yeah, I'll check that out.
Yeah, that one's really good. It came out in 2015. And in there, they mentioned some early accounts of how you hunt caribou with a bow and arrow, which, you know, as you're mentioning, you can drive these animals. They set up drive lines, cairns on the landscape and drove animals. That was a common, not only for hunting caribou, but for all sorts of animals. Another really good one is a book by George Frison called Survival by Hunting. That one's excellent. And he was an archaeologist that worked primarily in Wyoming. So your neck of the woods, if you haven't read that one, it's really good.
Yeah, I love books like
that. But another way you can hunt caribou. Say again?
I was just saying, I love books like that. So I appreciate you pointing those out.
Yeah, those two are among my favorites. Another way you can hunt caribou with a bow and arrow that they did historically was that you walk up to them very nonchalantly, right? You just kind of walk, not like walking right towards them, but maybe at an angle,
mm-hmm.
like minding my own business, nothing's going on. And they just stand there and look at you like, what is that? It doesn't look very threatening, you know, because animals, I don't know, you've experienced this. Animals can perceive threats mm-hmm. in your like body language. I can't tell you how many times that I've been deer hunting and look down and there's a squirrel, like literally hopping around right at my feet. And then I'm squirrel hunting and 100 yards away, they're up in a tree chattering at me. So you can walk up to a caribou just really nonchalant. And then when you get close enough, shoot them from the hip with your bow.
Wow.
Rather than raising it up, because that spooks them.
And it was,
so that's one way you,
they would have been so close that they would have been accurate doing that. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Within like, you know, 10, 15 yards. But you can do that when you have like people up on the edge of a boreal forest, a really small population of humans, a really small population of hunters. These are caribou that have never seen a human in their life. You know, they make this big yearly migration circuit up through the Arctic, through the tundra, and then come back down around on the southern edge of it. And suddenly there's this thing there they've never seen before. They've gone, you know, lived 2 or 3 years already. And the same thing, if you think about like early Neanderthals hunting with javelins, or if they're using lances, I assume that Neanderthals were, you know, pulling some pretty sophisticated hunting behavior, like driving these animals into pits or into like constructed corrals and that sort of thing. That's possible, or into nets. That's something that we probably wouldn't see archaeologically.
Right.
But even if they were, you know, corralling these animals or like pushing them and getting close with javelins, these could have been big herd animals. If you get one, it's a big payoff, right? It's a lot of meat. So there's a big incentive to do this. And it could have been a lot easier than we imagine. You know, if these animals aren't used to seeing humans, or they don't see that many of our kind of predator, they're not used to the kinds of tactics we use. But nevertheless, you know, regardless, early hunters who are hunting big animals, they had a lot of knowledge. They understood these animals. They observed them carefully. They understood their behavior. They knew how to track them. They could carefully read signs. So that's what it takes as a human to be successful. And there was a big incentive, a big payoff to do that early on.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you can answer this question either, because of the issue, a lot of natural materials not preserving well, but do we have any idea of what like a gear list of an ancient big game hunter would have looked like?
Yeah. Well, if you go back far enough in time, it is really hard to find preserved gear. If you look ethnographically, you're generally seeing people who have a projectile weapon and also a thrusting spear. You know, think about the Saan. They're using both. People in South America, they're actually using both because they use their bow and arrow, their bow itself. They'll unstring it. And that's their thrusting spear.
Okay.
They generally have a minimal but yet sophisticated toolkit. It's like carrying around a Leatherman. You know, it's less efficient to do any one task with that thing, but you can do all sorts of tasks with it.
Right.
So you'll see like interchangeable points, interchangeable fore shafts, some of them designed for hunting big game, some of them maybe poison, some of them designed for hunting small game. You can all fit out. In the Southwest, we have LL Dart main shafts that have a socket, and you can put in interchangeable fore shafts. So sophisticated toolkits that are like minimal, yet you can do all sorts of things with them.
Love it. And then maybe I'd assume they were wearing some sort of animal skin, right, for their clothing. They're probably a lot hairier than us too, at least from like, you know, the pictures you see of ancient human.
We're talking about, you know, strong, very fit people who you can look at modern distance runners, and I can't remember what the metrics were. They were looking at skeletal evidence of early humans and showing, well, they did a lot more moving along the landscape than even like distance hunters do. Very fit people, very strong people, and adapted. So they could wear a lot less clothing than we do now. But early on, you know, people like, we have evidence that Neanderthals were tanning hides and using their teeth as like a third appendage to like hold the hide, as a third hand kind of to hold the hide and while they worked it. So they were probably, and it makes sense, you're living in an ice age, yeah. Ice age Europe. You have to have some clothing. They were probably wearing animal hides. Yeah, going way back.
That's awesome. And you know, if we're talking about big game hunting, let's say with an atlatl, how heavy would that stone projectile in the front have been for a big game?
The dart point itself, something like 10 to 30 grams. So let's see, I can't put that into ounces. The dart itself, the complete dart, something like 3 ounces to up to 12 or even 14 ounces for a really heavy one. So in grams, 90 grams to like, over 400 grams for the dart. There's a huge range of variability in these weapons, and you can adapt them in terms of the size and the weight to hunting specific game. So most of the heavy darts you find are probably adapted to hunting larger game animals.
Yeah, it's pretty big, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think my darts. Yep.
How heavy is your dart, you were saying?
Oh, my darts tend to weigh 90 to 120 grams. I think I like replicating the lighter stuff from the U.S. Southwest. Like 120 gram dart feels a little heavy to me, but that's in the size range that it's really effective against like medium sized animals like white-tailed deer.
So have you actually, I'd assume you have, but have you hunted with an atlatl?
Not really. I've killed a rabbit or two, namely because in both the places where I've lived and hunted, in Arkansas and Colorado, it's not legal to hunt with this weapon.
Are there places, so in archery season, are there places where it is legal? Like, are there states?
Yeah. Missouri legalized the weapon not that long ago. It's legal in Alaska, I know. And I think there's a couple other states in the continental U.S. where it's legal to hunt with it. And you know, if you're hunting like pigs, or if you're hunting invasive hogs, usually you can hunt that within that level, but definitely check the regulations.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's fascinating. So did you ever have like a hunch to go do it, or, you know, since you're studying these weapons so much?
Yeah, I'd love to. And, you know, it's funny that my family's property in Arkansas, we always knew that hogs were going to come in there at some point and tear stuff up. But it wasn't until I moved to Colorado and started hunting out here and going to school out here that suddenly hogs showed up and started wreaking havoc on our property. I think we'd prefer to just have them gone, but I would definitely, if I was there hunting, I would definitely pursue that opportunity.
Yeah. And then I can relate, you know, I've had to deal with a lot of boar back in Germany, and they are a huge issue. They can breed super fast, 3 times a year, do a lot of damages to agricultural crops and lawns and whatnot. They taste great though. So, you know, going after them is a good pursuit. I've never tried one in the U.S. I've heard bad things, like people don't like the boar over here, especially in Texas and whatnot. My experience in Germany with boar has been always pleasant, so I don't know. It might just be what they're eating, yeah, or cultural thing.
Yeah, I know. My brother's eating a lot of them. The young ones and the young sows apparently taste good. The big boars, not good at all. But they really do a number on the landscape.
And yeah, native flora and fauna. So they definitely need to be hunted, and population should be controlled, in my opinion. So going back to the big game hunters though, I guess you answered this already, but you know, my question was, were we the first ones to use ranged weapons? But no, the Neanderthals had the javelins, right?
Yeah, we assume that Neanderthals were using them. I mean, those finds from Schöningen in Germany are almost certainly javelins. They're just really nicely weighted for javelins. So when, assuming that we're a different species than Neanderthals, if we're willing to make that distinction, which most anthropologists still are, when our species moved into to Europe, we weren't really using a more sophisticated weapon technology than Neanderthals. The archaeological evidence just doesn't support it. We were pretty much doing the same thing, probably hunting big animals with spears.
Right. And would it have been pretty hard for ancient humans to create some of these weapons? Do you think the resources were like readily available? Do we maybe see even like some trade routes going on, you know, that maybe certain resources for certain weapons were shared? I don't know if humans were at that point yet, you know, in the evolution when they were using some of these, but is there anything you can speak on with that?
Yeah, the big thing to look at is stone, because, you know, anywhere you go, there are places where you're going to have trouble finding good straight shafts or shafts that you can straighten fairly easily to make the darts from. An atletal is, you know, it's 2 foot stick. You can find something like that in most places. But the thing that you're going to be looking for and having a harder time finding is good nappable stone for efficient armatures. And when you make armatures from high quality stone, that's like fine grain stone, what I'm finding is that those are a lot sharper, they're a lot more efficient at penetrating, and they're probably a lot more lethal, you know, just from our own experience hunting animals. You have to have a sharp point on your arrow, and that's going to really increase the likelihood that you're going to retrieve that animal.
Right.
So early on, people are probably trading rock. They're moving good quality nappable stone long distances, and that's what they're really trading. That definitely increased, I think, with our species moving into Europe. Although it's one of those things that as we look more and more, yeah, actually earlier, you know, archaic humans were also, you know, trading these kinds of materials and moving stone long distances.
Yeah, it'd be so cool, like, to kind of, you know, sit down at where some of these different groups back then and kind of see how that would have gone down, you know, that sharing of not just resources, but also like the technological advances, like the ideas and all that. And I mean, I don't know to what extent that went on, you know, I'd assume we were pretty tribal back then, and maybe some of those technologies were kept secret, do you think? Or once we had this technology that it kind of diffused pretty freely through different groups? Is that anything?
I would imagine, I mean, I think one of the theories is with the bow and arrow is that one of the main mechanisms driving its distribution or people taking on that new technology was warfare.
Mm.
And so if you're coming across up against an enemy using that weapon, you're probably going to have, in most cases, in those kinds of encounters, you're going to have people getting away and saying, you know, they've got some kind of new weapon that has a lot faster projectile. Although that theory to me is problematic, because actually in Mesoamerica, as we know, the Aztecs continued to use atletals. That was the weapon of the elites, the elite jaguar and eagle knights. That was the weapon they used in battle. And we've also got people using that weapon. Yeah. There are also early accounts of people using atletals in what's now the United States for warfare. So I would imagine that there wasn't really, it wasn't so much that its slow advance and, you know, people acquiring this new technology wasn't so much that people were hiding it or they couldn't see it in other populations so much as that, you know, there was just this momentum, this tradition of how they hunted, what they did was effective. There's a tradition of it. And, you know, there's a decision there whether or not you're going to take on a new complex, harder to make, harder to maintain weapon with implications for your social structure. Because if you have people who are specialized in, like, you know, group, you know, coordinating group hunts, like group drives and that sort of thing, having a new weapon come along that now makes individuals more successful can be something that there's a conservatism against. You know, there's a conservatism for earlier, simpler, and more traditional hunting weapons.
And I mean, we see that today, even like, I mean, you know, back in Germany, at least, there's kind of a big no-no on a lot of the semi-automatic weapons with some of the older hunters and whatnot. So, you see, yeah, like you're saying,
yes.
And then that kind of explains how there might have been like, you know, why some weapons were still used, even though complex, more efficient weapons had been invented. So, yeah, it's fascinating stuff. I love it.
Right. Yeah.
I'd love to segue a little bit away from, you know, what these weapons are into more like how you specific, like as an archaeologist who's focusing on these ancient weapons, how are you studying these hunting methods of prehistoric man?
Sure. I do what's called experimental archaeology. And, you know, it's really just an archaeologist doing some experiments. So there's nothing really special about it. But I do experimental archaeology with replicas, mostly, of ancient hunting weapons, mostly focusing on the atlatl and the bow. And I've made mostly atlatls and darts from the southwestern U.S., and bows and arrows. I really like southeastern forms like Taba and Cherokee bows and arrows. But I've tested various other types, and I've done experiments where what you do is you get an animal carcass, a freshly dead one. The rancher has put these animals down mainly for us, and then we experiment on the carcass with a variety of projectiles and use high-speed cameras to film the impacts in slow motion. And you can, if you have a high-speed camera, filming orthogonal, or in other words, perpendicular to the trajectory of the projectile, you have markings on that shaft, you can actually track the velocity and then track the deceleration as the stone point penetrates and as the weapon penetrates through the body. And then you can track all the points where you have impacts and you get impacted armatures. So, you know, we're looking at the archaeological record. Every time we find a stone point, just about, we're finding it because it hit something and broke.
Mm-hmm.
It's got impact damage. Same thing with animal bone. So it's useful in these experiments. We see the performance of the weapon, and then we see how they break. So we make these experimental residues that are analogs for ancient hunting residues, both in terms of the broken projectile points, but also the bones, or, you know, butchering the animal afterwards. We keep all the meat and then clean up those bones. And you get bone, you know, lesions to bones where a stone point is impacted. You can watch in slow motion from behind as that point comes in and impacts, get the orientation on impact. You have the velocity. And so you have all these dimensions, the kinetic energy, the momentum, and you get a lot of details about what causes armatures to break, when they break different ways, the ways that they do, how you know, effective different designs are, and that sort of thing. And you know, just doing, I've only done a handful of these experiments, but every time you do one, it's incredibly insightful. You get a lot out of these experiments.
Sounds like a lot of fun, and the fact that you can get to keep the meat is awesome, of course. I feel like I've even heard of, like, I mean, we're still doing that today, kind of when we were testing broadheads and stuff like that, right? They're still kind of testing it often on animal carcasses, and it would make sense that the best way to really study how humans would have used it is to actually do it, right, and try it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, when you make these weapons and you use them on your own, and you build the dart. The dart has multiple components. You have to fit it together and figure out how to shape the foreshaft properly and all that. Just doing that, you know, that whole process of doing that, learning how it works, it's incredible. You can go into a collection, look at these artifacts coming out of, you know, dry shelters where you have wood components and things. And it's not like you're looking at something that you're like, that's an artifact, an old thing. You're looking at something that you know what it is. You're familiar with it. You know, you can see the decision-making process. You can see all the aspects like, oh, I know why they shaped, you know, the tang of the foreshaft that fits into the main shaft. I know why they shaped it that way. With a little, steeper taper at the top and then a more gradual taper going down. It all makes sense. It just looks familiar to you.
I love that.
So it's really useful for a whole number of reasons.
Well, and it's so cool because it seems like, yeah, that gives you almost like this exclusive access into like the mind of an ancient hunter, you know, just by kind of rationally going through the process of doing it and thinking about how, yeah, when you see, and then you actually get to see like how or why did it's this and this. It's gotta be a lot of fun. It's a cool job.
Yeah. I mean, it is, it's a lot of fun. It's really interesting. You get a lot out of it. You have to be careful that, you're not assuming that you know too much from your own experience making these things.
Right.
Because we're not ancient people, we're modern people, and that has various implications there, like the fact that I don't move across the landscape to the extent that ancient people did or have the musculature that they did. So there's limitations to it that you have to recognize, but it is extremely useful regardless.
Absolutely. And, you know, are there any lessons maybe you've gotten from these realistic experiments that might be relevant to hunters today?
Hunters today, yeah. I would say a lot of people that are probably interested in your podcast are like me in that they have this dedication, this devotion to like ancient hunting weaponry.
Right. Yeah.
And it's almost like if I'm hunting, no matter what, I'm going to be hunting with this old weapon technology. One thing I've learned just using these technologies is that they were effective in the right context, and they can be effective in the right context. But you know, the modern Son in Southern Africa, we assume that they're a lot better than we are at hunting. They just have like this incredible skill, which is very likely true. I mean, we definitely know that they were incredible trackers and just very good hunters all around. But they're reporting the same kinds of issues that we have as modern hunters. As things change there, as settlement sizes grow, as agriculture spreads and you have larger agriculture, big agriculture, as mechanized transport, you know, comes in and people start hunting with rifles, more people are hunting with rifles, it becomes increasingly more challenging for them to hunt with traditional weapons. And it's a familiar story because they're saying the animals are staying farther away from settlements. They're staying farther away from roads, which is one thing that if you hunt out west and you know, you got to get off that road, you know, like a mile or more.
Right. Yeah.
They're saying that we have to do these like expensive expedition hunts where we like borrow livestock so we can like move our supplies and carry meat back. It's all really familiar. So the way I've approach hunting is in archery season, by gosh, I'm using a bow. I'm making that bow and that's what I'm hunting with. In rifle season though, if I haven't filled my freezer yet, I don't feel bad about going out in the woods with my 30-06 and filling that freezer because, you know, the way things are now, it's just not the same. We're not living in the same world that people were back then.
Right. And I know you've also done some studies that looked at like the projectile points and if they were beveled or not. And I know there's a lot of discussions in the hunting community between, at least in the archery hunting community, between like single beveled, double beveled broadheads, which basically just is the edge like on a blade on what makes it sharp, right? Is there anything from your experiments with beveled ancient, you know, atlatl projectiles and whatnot that might be relevant to that discussion today?
Sure. Yeah, I think from these realistic or, you know, carcass experiments I performed, bevel points, of course, today, if you're looking down that point, you got two opposite bevels going different directions. And when it hits a body, it's going to be rotating. When it hits bone, it's going to like rotate and torque and split that bone. And you have a sudden decrease in the force of resistance on the trailing shaft of the projectile and a lot better penetration. That's important for the kinds of hunting that Dr. Ed Ashby is doing in Africa, where he was hunting really big animals. Some of those animals in Africa, they just have like a wall of ribs, you know, water buffalo.
Thick hide.
Yeah, real thick hide, real thick bones. We did an experiment on a bison. And if you're not using a dart that's heavy enough, it just stops dead when it hits a rib and just falls to the ground. So you have to have efficient projectiles that are gonna maintain that momentum and kinetic energy, even if you hit a rib. With dart points, ancient dart points, what we're seeing is that in the early archaic, starting around 10,000 years ago or so and lasting just a few thousand years, people are making projectile points that start off with a double bevel. And then as they get reworked, they become single bevel points. Because what they're doing is they're pressure flaking the edge. You know, you have like a bone or antler tool that you push up against the edge, and you push into the edge, and then you pull down, and you just kind of like lever off a little flake. As you pressure flake that edge, you make a lot of small flakes. It's a really good way to do the final shaping on the edge or to resharpen an edge. And as their points get dull and broke, they're just pressure flaking down one face. So they have like the point facing away from them maybe, or facing towards them either way. They're pressure flaking down one face of that edge, and then they just flip it over. You're not like turning the point, you're not changing its orientation, just flip it over. And now you're flaking the opposite edge. Mm-hmm. You're also flaking it the same direction. And as you do that, you're just removing flakes off one face of each edge, and they're the opposite face of each edge. And you end up with a point that becomes gradually more and more twisted as you rework it. The thing about those points, though, is that unlike modern beveled arrow points, they're not very thin. These are pretty thick points. So when they hit a bone, like a scapula or something, these are bones that single bevel modern broadheads will torque and twist and fracture. They're not doing that. They just punch through because they're pretty like thick points. And with any of these stone points, unlike a modern broadhead, when they hit a heavy bone, like a humerus or something, they pretty much just stop. And they might leave the little tip of the point embedded in that bone. But they're just, you know, a heavy point or heavy dart with like a big clothes point on it, I've seen just hit the humerus of a hog and just fall down and just leave the little tip embedded in that bone. Which to me is like, I don't know what's more ethical. What's more ethical, the ability to like torque and split a long bone of an animal if you miss and hit the wrong spot, or to just have a point that just hits it and stops. Yeah. So I can definitely see the use of like a single bevel broadhead. And I use them when I hunt elk and deer, but I don't know. It's an interesting topic for sure from the perspective of stone points.
Right. And it seems what's interesting is that they were using they were beveling their points back then already. So I think that's pretty cool to know. It's just another, you know, with all these things, it's like the more I know about how ancient humans used their hunting technology, it just makes me like appreciate what we have today so much more. And like, I just, like, even the little details like that, I think bring like more appreciation with it, just having that knowledge and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, there, one thing, when they're beveling those points, they're just flaking one face. That preserves material. Actually, that's probably the reason that they were doing that.
Okay.
So you have increasing longevity for that tool. which is really important if you're, you know, moving across the landscape hundreds of miles. So they had these toolkits. They were concerned in the longevity of their toolkits and the minimalism of their toolkits. They didn't want to have to carry too much stuff, understandably.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing that we can really, you know, look at ancient hunting toolkits and learn a lot is like how you hunt effectively with like a minimal amount of stuff.
Right. I like that. Yeah, that's a good takeaway there. So, you know, if we look at like our species as a whole today, right? And we kind of think about what we're doing here on the planet. To me, it's like we're definitely in this constant evolution and improvement of technology. Like that's one of our main focuses even today as a species. And so do you think like from everything you've told me today and knowing that the technology back then somewhat drove our evolution, do you think it like all started with hunting weapons, this kind of obsessive behavior to like make better technology?
Oh gosh. There were all sorts of tools that people relied on back then. And I think, you know, starting with probably Homo habilis around that time, I think that was 3 million years ago, is when people started becoming really concerned with tools and technology. And so our species has grown up with technology. You know, we've evolved with technology.
We're born into it almost.
Yeah, I mean, there's never a point in our evolution where our species has been without some form of technology. It's always part of our lives.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. It includes hunting technology. It includes, you know, clothing, technology to process plant foods, all very important. So I think it was probably all part of the same kind of cultural material apparatus that was going on right along with our development of our cognition and all that.
Yeah. I would like to think personally, you know, my own bias that that's what drove our like craving for better and better technology. But you make a really good point in that, like, yeah, we have always had some sort of technology or tool around, and it probably even started with a hominid before humans, you know?
Yeah, it definitely did. I mean, you can hunt effectively without very much at all. I think the Ache in South America, I was reading like 40% of the meat, almost 40 or up to 40% of the meat they get is just with their hands.
Oh, wow.
They have the bow and arrow. Yeah, it's like the bow and arrow. They don't, but when you kill a big animal with that, it's like a big payoff. Or with a thrusting spear, it's a big payoff. But just moving, they just move across the landscape through the forest in a line. And, you know, they'll get people over there if they find an animal, like a certain kind of animal that's like burrowing, and they'll spook it up out of the burrow and just grab it. It's like a lot of their hunting is just with their hands. So you don't necessarily need complex tools to hunt effectively. There are definitely situations where it's super beneficial.
All right. So, you know, kind of to wrap it up, what do you think, like, what is most fascinating to you about, you know, the ancient hunting cultures and tactics and technologies and whatnot?
Most fascinating, I think, is to me is how people did it effectively, how they were able to achieve success. And so that's why I've been so focused on, well, how do these weapons operate? Like, what's the ballistic properties of these weapons? What's the range? And what are the advantages that the newer, better weapons give you? And then like our relationship with our prey, because, you know, as, like we said, as our population gets higher, actually our success rates as hunters tend to go down. And I mean, you could see that like directly in wildlife management literature and tag sales to hunters. It's not necessarily like you can sell more tags and take out off more elk from the landscape. Maybe that the elk populations stay exactly the same. You just like have a lot lower success rates. So that to me, I think, is right now, that's the thing that like really grabs my attention, is like, how do they do it? And actually, from a young age, you know, like stalking squirrels in the woods with a spear, I've just always wondered, like, how did people do this? And it's just so challenging. But, you know, these are people that they grew up doing this from a young age, and they had just so much knowledge. That's the thing that I think we people may forget or overlook, is just how much knowledge it took and takes to hunt effectively with traditional weapons. And it's knowledge about the environment that you're hunting in and the animals that you're hunting. And so that, to me, I think one of our talking points as traditional hunters can be about moving forward, about conservation, and just, you know, build, you know, making people who are familiar with wild animals, wildlife, and wild landscapes.
I love that. Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking too when I was like thinking about the question. Was, you know, my own answer would have been like, yeah, how the heck did they get so good at this? And how it would just be awesome to just live with them for like a week, you know, back then, like hunt alongside a group of ancient hunters. That would be quite a treat.
Yeah. Oh man. Because, you know, if you read the literature on anthropology, where anthropologists are going in with hunting societies and going hunting with people, it's just amazing what they know. You know, it's like people hunting with blowguns in South America. Like, you're hearing something 50 yards off through the trees, can't see it, but you know exactly where it is. You know, it's like a male colobus monkey or whatever. Just from like the movements, the movement patterns that you're hearing, and things falling out of the canopy.
Unreal.
Yeah, and their ability to track. I mean, they just know so much. And so that, I think, you know, what can we take away from ancient hunters as modern hunters, is that we got a lot of catching up to do. Yeah, in terms
right. of, and like, of, I, you know, I seek out, like, yeah. I seek out hunting for like, for that deep connection that you were talking about that they had. Like, that's one of the reasons I seek out hunting. Obviously the food is honestly kind of one of my main drivers for wanting to do it. But like, the other thing is just this deep knowledge you gain along the way, how you were saying about not just like the hunting aspect, but also fauna and flora and fauna, right? Everything that's around you in your local environment. And yeah, it's just, I think, yeah, a good thing, it would be a good takeaway would be, you know, just keep working on it and keep focusing on that process rather than just a kill, right? Because you're missing out, and you're definitely not like playing catch, you know, we're not going to catch up with how ancient humans used to hunt if we just focus on the kill. So I'm sure they like were able to, you know, just recognize things in their environment, yeah, like how you were just saying that we, you know, we wouldn't even like, what is it, bad an eye to, I think is the saying, like we wouldn't even look, like see it or consider it at all. It's just fascinating stuff.
Or never hear it. And for them, a thing to remember is that for them also, it was a constant learning process. You know, they were constantly improving. Hunters in traditional hunting societies started becoming most productive in like their earlier mid-30s. And that's when they start being the most productive hunters in their camp or in their community.
That's interesting.
So it's this constant process. Yeah.
It's interesting because, like, I'm pretty sure today, us humans, aren't we, like, in our prime for, like, athletic performance when we're in our 30s? It probably has something to do with that, you know?
Yeah, that's part of it, but also the knowledge that you just continually gain. Every time you go out hunting, whether you're successful or not, you learn a lot about what you're hunting and the environment around you.
Right.
I mean, it took me, when I came out to Colorado, it took me a little bit to start getting to where I understood elk and I understood mule deer. And I just have learned so much about the Rocky Mountains doing that. So it's just like this continuous thing, as you just keep trying over and over again.
Oh, and that's how you will never get bored again either. Is kind of what I always say. You know,
right.
When you start engaging, like I do a lot of foraging too, and fishing, and when you do all these things, like try to live. When you start to live closer to how our ancestors lived, it's like boredom goes away because there's so many rabbit holes. Since we are still playing that catch up in terms of, you know, getting to that level of knowledge or getting even close. So, I mean, you know, I think we've talked about, I think we covered everything we wanted to cover. Is there anything else before we wrap it up that you think I didn't touch on, that I forgot to ask, that you want the people to know?
No, I mean, I think we've talked for a couple hours here.
Yeah, so almost two.
It's probably enough for your podcast. And I guess, you know, if you want to come back and hit this again at a later date, that's...
Yeah, this is definitely, you know, there's so much here that you could really just do a podcast on, like, just the Adelaide, just the Javelin, I bet. And it would be really interesting.
Yeah.
So I'd love to, absolutely. If you're interested, let's do it.
Yeah. Yeah. We didn't talk about the survey, but, you know, again, we can, that can be a future.
Right. Yeah. We'll touch on that in the future. So listen, man, I think it's a good place to end. It was really a pleasure talking to you, and, you know, I appreciate you letting me pick your brain a bit, and, you know, now I can share this with all the listeners and they can learn from it. So it's one of my favorite things about doing the podcast. If someone wants to know, like, kind of follow you on the journey, on your journey, and maybe dive deeper into some of these subjects, maybe look at some of your scientific articles and read about your experiments, where do they find you?
I'm on Instagram at AR, as in Arkansas, AR Atlatl, AR Atlatl on Instagram. And you can find me on my website that I run with a friend, basketmakeratlatl.com. That one has, you know, more accessible kind of research that we've done on atlatls, North American atlatls especially. So if you're interested in making these things or studying the artifacts, that's definitely the place to go. And you can check for more content on there as things progress.
Awesome. Are you going to be ever, have you ever thought about doing like online videos and, or maybe like an online course and, you know, how to build one of these and how to throw
I've got
one?
I've got some material online at AR Atlatl on YouTube.
Okay.
That's my YouTube handle. So I've got some simple tutorials there on how to make darts and that sort of thing.
Perfect.
So you might find some information there.
Cool. And I'll link all of that in the podcast description so that all of you listening can easily find Devin's work. And I encourage you to look into it because it is just super fascinating stuff. So yeah, I really appreciate you coming on, man. Let's definitely do this again.
Sounds great.
All right. That's all I got for you guys today. I hope you guys loved this conversation as much as I did. I had so much fun talking to Devin and, you know, this anthropology and archaeology and understanding how our ancient or how our ancestors really lived and hunted and, you know, got quality of life and what they ate. It's all so, so, so fascinating to me. And I know there's a lot of ambiguity around it. And, you know, the information is changing as we discover new things. But I think it's just great to stay on top of all that knowledge and maybe even, you know, draw some of those data points or, you know, look at some of that data that we're finding there and use those interpretations of how people lived back then and try to, you know, incorporate some of that into our own lives, especially when it comes to food. So again, if you want to support the podcast, follow it, leave a review, share it with a friend, support it with a $2 donation on Patreon, less than a cup of coffee. It's going to let me buy a lot more coffee and, you know, just pump out more episodes for all of you. I've got a lot of cool episodes ready. So until next time, my friends, let's keep exploring real food together.